So there has been a lot of talk and some real serious angst expressed during the course of this pandemic relative to bans. Bans being implemented, bans being ignored, bans being declared constitutional by one judge and unconstitutional by another judge. So probably the last thing some of you wanted to see in my sermon title this morning was the word ban. But whether we like bans or not, James offers his own ban. And it's a ban on favoritism. I received a couple of emails this week from very perceptive people who wanted to know why I only addressed one part of that famous saying at the very end of the first chapter when James says pure religion, what religion is all about is helping orphans and widows in their distress. That part we talked about last week. But James went on. Pure religion, what it's all about is helping orphans and widows in their distress and remaining unblemished by the word. To be blemished means to be scarred or marked or tainted or even stained by your contact with the world. Ancient folks actually believed that in and through contact with the world, in and through the experience of sin, our souls actually become stained. They become tainted, blemished, darker. In the Old and New Testament, the world is understood as more than just a place that is outside the church. The world is a complex makeup of different kinds of systems and structures and people who knowingly or unknowingly live lives that are opposed to God. The world, we are told in Scripture, is under the dominion of Satan, and the world has its own unique beliefs and values. Paul said that we are to be in the world, but not of the world, which was Paul's way of saying that this is the plane of existence within which we live, and we cannot separate ourselves entirely from that. We cannot step out from that. We're in the world. But do not be of the world was Paul's clever way of saying, don't let the values and the beliefs and the ways of the world influence you, determine your values and ways and beliefs. To use James and Jesus's terminology, when we embrace the values and beliefs of the world, we become double-minded, double-souled, and our faith is stained or polluted. So pure religion keeps itself from being polluted by the world by not embracing the ways and the beliefs and the values of the world. Now, I said that the final verse in chapter 1 served as the perfect bridge, if you will, to chapter 2 for this simple reason. In chapter 2, we witnessed one of the ways that the values of James' world, the values in Jewish culture and in Roman and Greek culture, the values in the world have begun to influence the values of the church. So what I want to do this morning is really very simple, but like all the rest of James, it's so hard to swallow. That's the problem with James. You don't get a break. You don't have that passage where you can go, oh, okay, that one was a little bit easier. It didn't hit me quite as hard. James just paragraph after paragraph after paragraph just keeps challenging us as believers. So the first thing I want to do in verses 1 through 4 is I want to look at how the values of the world had crept into James's church via his brothers and sisters showing favoritism to the wealthy. this act of favoring the wealthy is what actually brought about this ban on favoritism. Then second, I want to look at a very practical argument that James makes. In addition to a very theological argument and a very biblical sort of argument, James makes a very practical argument about why it is absolute foolishness to favor the rich, the wealthy. And then finally, we'll look at this interesting theological argument that's based on the very person of God, the character of God, and the practices of God, and then this biblical argument that he makes. So James tries to construct this argument, one that is very, very practical, one that is also very theological and very biblical. So with that in mind, let's begin by looking at how the values of the world had crept in to James's church via the church favoring the wealthy. In order to understand these first few verses, we have to understand a little bit about the ancient world in which this passage was written. In many regards, it's strikingly similar to ours in terms of favoring the wealthy and the powerful. Very, very, very similar. In both ancient Jewish and Roman cultures, there was a tremendous tendency among people to show favoritism to the wealthy. In Jewish culture, it was believed that to be wealthy meant that you were blessed by God. If a person possessed a significant amount of riches, they believed that that person possessed those riches because they were directly favored, advantaged, blessed by God. Jesus challenges that whole teaching and understanding, but that is what they believe. Now, they also want to step further, and they believe that if you, as a person who was poor, showed favoritism towards somebody who was wealthy, it could advantage you. You could get some goods out of it. And so, for example, Josephus, a first century Jewish historian, tells us that when a wealthy person went into the market, they rarely, if ever, had to spend any of the money. Because the fishermen and the shepherds and all the different tradespeople would literally give their goods to the wealthy in order to try to curry favor with them. They praised them. When they walked in the market and in the temple, they would even literally lay down their coats for them to walk on. Does that sound familiar? From Palm Sunday? They did all of this because in their minds, they believed that if they showed favor to the wealthy, then they were in essence praising God for God's actions of blessing those people. And they believed that by doing this, they themselves might be blessed with riches as well, or at least blessed by that wealthy person. The Romans had a very similar sort of practice. It was just way, way, way bigger and more dramatic. So all of the things were largely the same. When the wealthy went into the marketplace, rarely, if ever, did they have to spend any of their money. They were literally just given goods that they wanted because people wanted to curry favor. So the very people who could afford to buy that stuff actually didn't have to buy it. And the wealthy, we know, especially in a Roman context, would take advantage of that and buy an inordinate amount, or not buy, just be given an inordinate amount of goods from people who were desperately trying to curry favor with them. We're told that in a Roman context, it was quite often like a parade when a very wealthy person came down into the marketplace, because they too would lay down their coats, but they would even praise and worship them as though they were gods, because they believed that they must be very, very close to the gods because they're so wealthy. So, in this cultural context in which James was writing, people favored the wealthy in hopes that it would advantage themselves. So when we look at verses 1-4, the background behind this is probably just a very simple worship service or some sort of meeting or gathering. And we're told that a very wealthy person comes in to the worship center, into the gathering, and they're given a seat of honor. And that's very typical for a Jewish context. Remember, Jesus criticizes them for giving away the best seat to the powerful and the wealthy. And here we see them doing exactly what Jesus has told them they are not supposed to do. The last are to be first, the first are to be last. All those wonderful teachings that Jesus offered. But in James's church, just a short period of time after Jesus' death and resurrection, they're giving the wealthy person a place of honor and prestige. And then when the poor person comes in with shabby clothes, they're told to stand over in the corner or sit by their feet. Their act of favoritism not only lifts up the wealthy, it puts down the poor. And that is what leads to this ban. Most commentators suggest that whatever it was that took place, more than likely took place in James's church of worship, because it's so specific and so particular in its definition and description. And I would imagine he must have been absolutely appalled at what he saw, resulting in this very powerful statement in terms of his ban on this practice. Now, in the verses that follow, James makes three basic arguments against this kind of ban. One of them is theological, in other words, based on the character and the practices of God. One of them is biblical. It's based on some biblical passages that James wants to explore. And the other one is actually based in what we would call practical wisdom. And so, beginning with the argument that James makes about practical wisdom, as I said, they would have been advantaging the rich, favoring the rich, because they believed in their minds that in some way, shape, or form, they're going to be benefited from that. Either that wealthy person is going to advantage them in some way, shape, or form, or God, who they believe made that person rich because they're praising them, is going to make them rich. So they believe in some way, shape, or form, they're going to get some good out of this, and they're going to get good from favoring the wealthy, and the poor who don't have anything, well, they're going to dishonor them because they don't have anything to advantage them with. That's the thinking that's going through their mind when they're doing this. And James comes along, and his first argument is that, just look at this from the perspective of common sense. This is absolute foolishness. And he asks them the rhetorical question, who is it that is dragging you? And that word in the Greek for dragging, for hauling you off, is a word that is filled with violence. They are being violently and physically hauled off into court. By whom? By the wealthy. The very people that they believe could advantage them are hauling them off to court, where the courts are entirely in their favor, and the wealthy are just going to disadvantage them. Whatever little bit they have left will be taken from them. And so James, in essence, is saying, wake up, open your eyes. This doesn't make any sense. Why are you advantaging the people who are directly disadvantaging and will continue to do so? And again, I say continue to do, because this is where I have to get into the Greek. You know me. He uses the present imperative, which means ongoing, continual action. That's what's taking place. And he's like, this is crazy. Why are you doing this? It makes no sense. That's his first argument. The second argument that James makes against favoring the rich, really the first in the biblical flow, but in the flow of the text, is a theological argument that looks at this issue of favoring the wealthy and discriminating the poor against the character and the action of God. And we know from a multitude of different Old Testament passages that God shows no favoritism. As a matter of fact, if any favoritism is shown, as James has already told us in chapter 1, and we're told throughout the Old Testament as well, if any favoritism is shown by God, it is shown toward the poor. Now, as we talked about a few weeks ago, when James uses the word potokos, the Greek word for poor, he's literally referring to a specific class of people, largely within Jewish culture, who were indeed very, very poor, but had remained faithful to God. So as I said last time, being poor isn't an automatic guarantee of eternal bliss and salvation. That's not what James is saying. But this class of people who were very poor and had suffered persecution, as we talked about in the first sermon, those people have continued to maintain their faith in God, and God blesses them and favors them. And so what James is saying in essence is, again, this doesn't make any sense. Your practices, your beliefs are in direct opposition to the practices and character of God. And as people who worship God and praise God, we're called to reflect the character and practices of God. And James wants to make it absolutely, positively clear to them that what you are doing is inconsistent with the God that you are worshiping. And that's a very, very powerful argument that James makes. In addition to this theological argument that's based on the character and action of God, James offered what we would call more of a biblical type argument. In the book of Leviticus and in the teachings of Jesus, the royal law, meaning the highest or the greatest or the best law, said, love your neighbor as yourself. It's there in Leviticus. Jesus repeats it, of course. Love, both in the Old Testament and especially in the New Testament, is indiscriminate in nature. We love all people, regardless of whether they are rich or poor, right or left, black or white, male or female, gay or straight. We love all people. For James and Jesus, our neighbor is anyone who is in need. And we are called to love indiscriminately. But if we show favoritism, like is done in the world, then our love is limited, it's restricted, it's discriminatory in nature. And because of that, we sin by breaking the royal law and become lawbreakers in their entirety. Now, James inserts these statements about adultery and murder. And it seems so random. Like, boop, just pulls that out of nowhere. But here's the connection. Jewish people believed that perhaps the two greatest sins were adultery and murder. And they were so for this reason, because many, many people are hurt and because it shows favoritism. Because it shows favoritism. So my iPhone is down there. Let's just use the illustration of murder. And let's say Snooki really, really, really wants my iPhone back. I don't know why she would. It's an iPhone 5. The sound doesn't even really work. Case is all cracked, but she does. So she murders me to get my iPhone. The ancient Jewish people would have said, in addition to people being hurt by that and lives be torn asunder, what Snooki is doing is showing favoritism. She's favoring herself and my iPhone over my life. She's weighing them in the scales, and for some reason, we know she'd never do this. So just picking on her, because we know what I can pick on her, because she'd never do that. In the scales, for some bizarre reason, she's valuing that iPhone and her desire for that iPhone more than my very life. We have to have that explained to us in order to get it. James just had to say it, and they would have got it immediately. That what he is talking about is very, very serious stuff, because he links it to what they believe were the big ones. So he makes this biblical argument that we're called to practice a love that is absolute and indiscriminate. And by showing favoritism, we're discriminating between them. Now, there are many ways that we can apply this passage to our lives. And like ancient cultures, we live in a culture that in different ways favors the rich and dishonors the poor. In our culture, we think of the poor. When we think of the poor, we more often think in negative terms. Uneducated, lazy, dirty, untrustworthy. When we think of the wealthy, we often think in terms of educated, hardworking, clean, trustworthy. We live in a culture where people will pay top dollar to sit at a seat to watch actors and actresses walk down a red carpet. And we'll clear their schedule so we can watch it on TV. We live in a culture where we significant favor and value wealthy. We do that in different ways too. There are other things. Education. Craig Blomberg, in his commentary, I studied under Craig way back in seminary days, and Craig loved to tell this story when he taught a class on the book of James. He had just come to Denver Seminary, so he wasn't necessarily known by it. And he was going to be the resident New Testament expert who was going to be responding to this other scholar's presentation, and he would be giving a response to it after everybody had coffee and cookies. One of these seminar type things. And this guy had made his presentation, and we were starting to get ready for this response. And Craig noticed the students who were setting up the coffee and the cookies and, you know, all that sort of stuff were completely overwhelmed by the herd of people who would rush the tables. And it was just absolutely just like Craig Blomberg. He got up from where he was seated, out of the line, and started pouring coffee cups and handing out cookies. And the person who had made the presentation came up next in line, and before Craig handed him his coffee or soda, whatever he wanted, and a couple of cookies, he started to introduce himself. And the guy literally didn't swap, but just kind of pushed his hand out of the way and said, "Let's just keep this to coffee and treats." Because in his opinion, Craig was just manager of the desserts. 10 minutes later, Craig is being introduced as the most recent addition to Denver Seminary with a PhD from the University of Aberdeen, which is a big deal in the New Testament. And he said for the rest of the weekend, that guy did everything he could to curry Craig's favor. That's looking at externals and judging people based on them and valuing them because of those. Whether it's wealth or education, whatever it might be. James puts a ban on that. It's almost as if he's saying, just value everybody. Our law is indiscriminate. The last application I want to make is about this relationship between church and the world, believer. That's how chapter 1 ends, by keeping oneself unstained by the world. And then chapter 2 opens with them being terribly, terribly stained by the practices and values. That's the connection that James wants us to make. George Barna, in a book called The Frog in the Kettle, talks about this issue of our relationship with the world around us. And he uses this analogy because, and I never knew this, and I'm not going to experiment with it, I'm terribly, terribly masochistic because I'm a poor little frog. But he says, if you put a frog in a kettle in cold water and turn the heat up, it will literally stay in there and boil itself alive. It will not jump up because it has become acclimated, adapted to that environment. Barna suggests that far too many of us, and I'm using us, I'm not going to say too many of you, using us, so yeah, me too. Far too many of us have become so acclimated, so adapted, so in essence determined by the world around us that we can't even see it. And we're burning up. I can see it in you and you can see it in me, right? That's why we need Christian community, an authentic Christian community where we can really talk about how we're being stained by the world around us. Because again, I can really see it in the healthy, wealthy, and gospel, healthy, wealthy, and wise gospel. Oh, I can see how they're completely adapted to it and just going right in the flow. But you know what? They're saying exactly the same thing. And those type of conversations help us to be able to see what perhaps we don't want to see because we're like that frog in the kettle. And our faith is getting burned up. So James, in his ban on favoritism, challenging, challenging stuff. Because it almost seems to be an intuitive sort of way that we relate to the people and to the world around us. To show favoritism in hopes of advantaging ourselves. Instead, James says, just love. Just love indiscriminately.